Coming up on today's programme, what impact is the COVID surge having on our hospitals? Are the latest proposals enough to get the National Maternity Hospital over the line? And with the Garda investigation closed, when will the HSE publish the report into sexual assault in a Donegal care home? We'll talk to HSE Chief Paul Reid. Keystone Cops meets Father Ted Stuff. We talk to Vintners Chief Donal O'Keefe on why he says the new nightclub COVID routes are unworkable. And wake up call, can we cut carbon emissions if we don't cut the national herd? Good afternoon and welcome to Saturday with Katie Hannan. My panel today, Robert Troy, Minister of State at the Department of Enterprise, Trade and Employment, Eoin O'Riordan, Labour Spokesperson on Education, Enterprise and Trade, and Verona Murphy, Independent TD for Wexford. You can text us on 51551, email saturday@rte.ie, or you can tweet to @SaturdayRTE. But first today, the Department of Health has confirmed 2,427 new cases of COVID-19. There are 449 people in hospital and 93 of which are being treated in ICU. Paul Reid, CEO of the HSE, joins me now from our Athlone studio. Good afternoon, Paul.
Good afternoon, Katie.
Paul, the latest wave of COVID-19 infections is putting pressure on intensive care units and hospitals all around the country being forced to cancel surgeries. Can you give us an update on the situation in relation to that?
Yeah, if I can address your question from two perspectives. First, what's happening in hospitals and then ICU. In a hospital perspective, as you mentioned, we have 450 cases now just about in hospital-positive COVID cases. Which is putting severe pressure across our hospital system. We do expect those numbers to rise throughout the weekend and indeed over the next few weeks. So that's a really cause of concern for us. It is no doubt when we take in context COVID, but also the other illnesses that we're treating, increased respiratory illnesses coming through, early identifications of flu, and emergency attendance is up very significantly based on delayed care from COVID. Huge pressure on our hospitals. Resulting impact is, I suppose, in terms of elective care, a number of hospitals across the country have had to take decisions to cease elective care for some points of time, maybe not completely.
Can I ask you which hospitals we're talking about?
Yeah, across the six hospital groups in total, including Children's Health Ireland, and about 20 hospitals overall across the country. So certainly in Limerick, Galway, Navan, Wexford, Cork. Pretty much various hospitals around the country, including Children's Health Ireland, they've had to take a number of actions to, in many cases, not completely cease, but certainly turn down elective care and in some cases stop for a period of time. So we are beginning to see the pressure and the resourcing that's required to address COVID impact on non-COVID care and particularly elective care.
What kind of procedures are being cancelled now?
It'll be a range of procedures, but obviously urgent care. If people have urgent care, it's being treated. So cancer and cardiology and all urgent care. A couple of actions that we are taking just to relieve the pressure. We're still working with the private hospitals to take up some capacity, who they themselves, in fairness, have a reasonable limited capacity too. But we are roughly about 1,100 beds per week utilising private hospital capacity. I should say we had just finalised a set of actions to address the rising numbers of, I guess, the waiting list that we have, to try at least during the period of now December not have them rise. We're still very anxious to do that.
You going to be able to do that if you're dealing with the kind of numbers you're talking about now?
No, it's a real challenge for us, particularly as we head into the winter. This is going to be probably one of the most difficult winters we've faced in many years. So it is difficult for us. We are trying to put in some capacity out of hours in the public system and, as I mentioned, some extra capacity in the private system. But it's a real challenge from what we're seeing. From an ICU perspective, I'm going to just address briefly. I mean, we have 93 people in ICU. That is our real level of concern because that's 93 out of 296 available ICU beds at the moment. And that's impacting particularly. And I would like to make the message quite strongly, you know, and we've been publishing this regularly, but, you know, 57% of the people in ICU have not been fully vaccinated, which is a strong impact on it. You know, if you take it, there's just over 300,000 of the population. You know, that's a big impact for us. And talking to Dr. Coleman O'Loughlin and Dr. Catherine Mudaway, who'll be two consultants in intensive care over the last 24 hours, you know, what they are seeing, particularly in ICU, are younger, unvaccinated people in the ages 30 to 40 years of age groups. And sadly, in some case, deaths to unvaccinated people under the age of 25. So I would make a really strong urgent call. We are a number of initiatives over the next week. to support those people who are unvaccinated, who have any concerns they have, to come forward and be vaccinated.
So you want to get the message out there that just because you are not in the over 60s or even over 50s cohort, that you are still vulnerable and you could end up in ICU, and that's, you are seeing people in that age group in ICU right now.
Yeah, that age group, young age groups, unvaccinated, and for those who are vaccinated, it's predominantly comorbidities and immunosuppressed. I mean, I just make the point, Dr. Colm O'Loughlin made this point to me, and anxious that I stress it. You know, the severity of COVID is something none of us should understate, because he was making the point to me, if a person is admitted to ICU with severe HIV or AIDS, that person's chance of survival being admitted and treated is probably stronger than if you're admitted with severe COVID disease, because there's good treatments for HIV and those complications, but not such for COVID. So, you know, I really want to stress this is quite a serious illness impacting everybody and younger people, but you do have a higher level of protection if you're vaccinated.
Okay. Can I go back to the other care that's been compromised for a moment? And you mentioned there children's health is being compromised. We heard yesterday from your colleague Anne O'Connor that there were only 12 hospital beds available for children throughout the country, and no ICU beds were free yesterday. Can you tell us what the update on that is?
Yeah, it hasn't significantly changed. If you take across the country, there's about 120 beds available now. That can change in any given day, can range general beds. As of this morning, though, in terms of overall in children's hospitals, again, smaller numbers of beds, exactly as my colleague outlined yesterday, and of ICU beds available across the country. We have about 11 ICU beds, adult beds, but no ICU beds available for children at this moment point in time. So that is the pressure points we're seeing, we're experiencing. And I guess my call to everybody is, you know, we're in a difficult period. We're in a period where the society and enterprises open up, and we welcome that, because everybody needs to get on and move on with their lives in a very safe way. But we have to do it in a very safe way, and a really urgent call to people. We can turn this around. This can be turned around as quickly as it turned around badly for us. It could be turned around positively, but it will need a really strong collective call to everybody, all of us individually, enterprise, business. Let's do things very safely.
What about booster shots then, Paul Reid, for the 60 to 80 year olds that NIAC have now approved? When will those people get their call?
Yeah, just say three things of boosters. So firstly, we're obviously progressing through the previously recommended immunocompromised people over 65 in long-term care facilities and those over 80, and making good progress throughout all of those. For the 60 to 80s, having received the recommendations from NIAC, we are putting together the operational plan about how we'll go about this. We expect to have that finalised by the end of next week at the latest, and commence those over very shortly after that. And we would envisage it'll be about a 6 to 6 week period or so. But we will start to call. We will be proactively calling those people in the age of 60 to 80s.
And what will forward. They do? Can they expect a text? How will it be organised?
Yeah, again, we're finalising the details in terms of the channels that we will do it between vaccination centres and other channels that we have, working with GPs and others. So we're finalising the detail, but people can expect to be contacted proactively in this case, because in the previous occasion you registered online, particularly for those aged 60 to 70. We will be making contact. We're obviously addressing those people based on a sequential basis. So the NIAC recommendation is, you know, within 6 months of their previous vaccination. So we will be working through that.
Can I just
make the point just on boosters, if I can. I mean, NIAC will continue to make recommendations where next after that. But I just would, again, make the point, we fully respect the NIAC, have the expertise in it. My concern is growing and heightening in terms of healthcare staff. You know, we increasingly have more and more staff out with COVID or symptomatic close contacts, about 1,800. That'll probably grow to 2,000 shortly. We're seeing more outbreaks, you know, and I think from my perspective, we have a duty of care to staff. We have a duty of care to vulnerable patients. So I would be really anxious that decision is made sooner rather than later. It's going to take us time anyway to vaccinate healthcare workers.
The INMO have been in touch with you in relation to this, haven't they?
Oh yeah, on a regular basis, in fairness. And you know, it's not just the trade unions or staff are regularly saying this to me. Our medics throughout, our chief clinical officer, we are all very, very anxious to get healthcare workers vaccinated. I am quite concerned with seeing outbreaks emerging. We know when the virus is so strong in the community, it increases the risk of outbreaks in healthcare settings. You know, and for example, we have all the residents in long-term care facilities fully vaccinated very shortly, those over 65. And we really wanted to make sure that the staff in those facilities are vaccinated too. So, you know, no, it's across the board. We're really anxious.
And in relation to that staffing crisis, if we can put it that way, is this going to have more knock-on effects for other care? Because presumably all you can do is redeploy staff from other care roles.
We do. Now, thankfully, we haven't reached the levels that we reached in January, and we don't expect to reach the levels that we reached in January, both in terms of hospitalisations, but equally in terms of healthcare staff out. But specifically to your question, yes, we are obviously on a significant recruitment campaign, but that takes time. And we do have to redeploy. And I know there's a constant expectation that when do we get into surge, particularly in terms of ICU. But surge is not a magic switch that we can turn on. Surge means moving people from one level of healthcare to another. And we are very anxious in the health service to address people's care beyond COVID and the waiting list that we have. That's a real cause of concern for us. So, yes, it would mean redeploying people. Particularly to surge, but it does mean taking people from other care.
Can I ask you then about COVID certs and the suggestion this week that they should be made compulsory for people visiting patients in hospitals and in nursing homes, because we are seeing an increase in outbreaks in both those settings now?
Yeah, well, I kind of separate the two issues. Certainly outbreaks is a cause of concern within healthcare settings, and we have to address that. We do know that when we have higher levels of community, it gets practically impossible to build a complete wall that transmission does not emerge into the healthcare settings, specifically related to having COVID certs for visitors. Look, we've heard that. We have to look at it. There's significant operational implications about how you would do that, how you'd operationalise. One of the things I want to make sure is we don't put an increased burden on our health staff in terms of what they're having to do, the care they're having to manage,
presumably, if you were operating this policy for visitors, there would then be questions asked about vaccination status of staff again.
Yeah, and 2 points on that, just to make relative to my previous point, you know, we would be urging people to get vaccinated. So certainly if your loved ones or family members are in hospital to get vaccinated, or in a long-term care facility to get vaccinated for those visits. Secondly, and specifically related to healthcare staff, yes, I mean, I've consistently said this. First of all, we have an extremely high uptake, probably one of the highest uptakes in many healthcare settings across the world of our healthcare workers getting vaccinated, and that's good. But I would make a very strong call to any other healthcare workers who haven't. We would expect people, healthcare workers, to take up this vaccination. And thankfully, we have seen a huge, strong take-up.
Okay. If I can move you away from COVID just for a moment, because the Irish Times is reporting today that a Garda investigation into the prolonged sexual abuse at a HSE-run disability facility in County Donegal has closed, with the DPP instructing there should be no prosecution. This unpublished report from the National Independent Review Panel found devastating abuse had been perpetrated on mainly non-verbal adults by another resident with the full knowledge of staff and management. Minister of State Anne Rabbitt has reiterated her call for the full report to be published, as have the families of the victims here who spoke to Kitty Holland. Are you now, or is the HSE now, going to publish the report in full, Paul Reid?
Yeah, I'll just make a few points on this. First of all, this is the first such report that has come to myself, you know, on my watch since I've joined the HSE. And I've been very anxious that we do everything with this appropriately and we don't compromise any step along the way, which has happened in previous reports. Immediately brought this report to our board, our Safety and Quality Committee of the board are overseeing all of our steps in relation to this, and equally in terms of notification to An Garda Síochána. We are taking the full advice from An Garda Síochána about when and at what appropriate time we can publish this report. First of all, I'm extremely anxious to publish this. The reports, the detail of this report are quite gruesome, quite difficult to read. And I do want to make sure that gets out. I have no interest in secrecy. I want openness, transparency, and my board want that. So we're liaising with the guards in a Garda Síochána. We'll be clear from Gardaí when we can do it, and we'll obviously be working with the families before part of publication. But I do want to do this at as soon as possible time we can.
And just to be clear, because there was some suggestion that the HSE was only prepared to publish the executive summary of the report, whereas the Minister wants the entire report into the public domain. Would you support the Minister's position on that?
Well, I think no. I think there's a misperception about an executive summary or what that is. What we are doing is there was a National Independent Review Panel, as you referenced, Katie, at the start, published this. That process is done to give people who contribute and come forward with protection in terms of when it's published. So what we are publishing is not a 2 or 3 page executive summary. This is a quite detailed report that protects people's anonymity, but also publish the full details of the findings, the full details of the facts, and the full details of the recommendations. So it's not a 2 or 3 page executive summary.
But it's not the full report.
It's the only difference will be, Katie, is it does protect the National Independent Review Panel process, and it protects the request that we have got from the chair of the National Independent Review Panel. So, but you know, to reassure everybody, all of the gruesome details of this will be published once we clear details with an Garda Síochána and once we work through the final details with the families.
Okay, and but given that we understood that the delay in publication was because the Garda Síochána was saying they wanted to have their investigation concluded before you publish this, given that is concluded, can we expect this now in the coming days?
I'd expect it soon. We want to immediately pick this up with an Garda Síochána, who've just said this week or the last 24 hours or so that they've got clearance from the DPP. We literally got a letter last week from a Garda Síochána to say don't. So that's an emerging process that's happened over the last 24 hours.
A week ago on Garda Síochána, we're still saying don't publish.
Oh yeah, up to about 10 days ago, we would have got the letter from Garda Síochána. So we're happy, we're anxious. Happy is the wrong word, but we're content that once we find the right process with the Garda Síochána to publish, and I obviously work things through with the families involved.
Okay, and finally then, before I let you go, Paul Reid, there's another story in the front of the Irish Times today telling us that the state could take control of the new national maternity site for 299 years under fresh proposals to settle the long-running dispute over its governance. The paper is reporting that under the terms of the agreement, the HSE will own the building on a ground lease of 299 years and there will be a change to the board composition to include 3 public interest directors. Is this a significant development?
Well, first of all, look, from HSE's perspective, I think from everybody, this is a fantastic project, and it's really of key central importance for women's health in Ireland. I know the Minister is on the record and he wants to be sure that the governance and structure is right about this, and that's those issues and those policy issues have been led by the Department and indeed the Minister over the past few weeks, and I'm not privy to those discussions, but the Minister has made it clear he wants to bring proposals to government that does safeguards the state investment. So we and the HSE board will consider those proposals when finalised and do it at the sharpest possible term once they're ready for the HSE to review, HSE board to review.
Okay, so they haven't been signed off on yet, or given any, the HSE board hasn't given any indication yet of where it stands in relation to these proposals.
Well, I think the HSE board, I know, are very anxious to see this project through, but they haven't reviewed any further final revisions at this stage.
Okay.
And will do so once they're available.
Okay. Paul Reid, many thanks for giving us your time today. That's Paul Reid there, CEO of the HSE from our Athlone studio. Minister Robert Troy, I'll get to the COVID questions in a moment, but just quickly, that story on the National Maternity Hospital. What's your understanding of the situation in relation to that today?
Well, to be frank, the first time hearing of it is when I saw it on the Irish Times this morning. I think it, as Paul Reid has said a moment ago, is a very significant investment, long overdue investment, and one that we need to see happening for the betterment of women's health. My colleague, the Minister for Health, has continuously said that he will not bring forward any proposal to government unless that he can be certain that all services that will be provided at the facility will be all legally permissible services, and that he can be sure that the state's investment is safeguarded beyond any reasonable doubt. So I would expect that when he feels that an agreement is reached that fulfills those parameters that he would be in a position to bring a member of the government.
Have you any sense of that? Does what has been set out in these proposals today, does that meet those criteria?
I haven't spoken to my colleague, and I don't want to speak on his behalf. All I want to say is reiterate the point that he has made on a number of occasions. He will not be bringing a memo to Cabinet until such time as that he is satisfied that the services provided by the National Maternity Hospital will be all legally permissible services, and that the investment that the state is making in this much overdue infrastructure protected.
Sorry to cut across you, but I just want to put you a very brief statement that we got from the St Vincent's Healthcare Group shortly before we came on air. They told us that St Vincent's Healthcare Group has constantly sought to work with the National Maternity Hospital and government to deliver a much needed maternity hospital for the women of Ireland. We are very pleased to confirm that discussions have concluded and our proposal of an extended lease and enhanced board representation have been accepted by the Department of Health and the National Maternity Hospital Board. That sounds like it's a done deal there. That's from the one party to this deal, the Vincent's Healthcare Group.
As I said, I can't answer any further, Katie. I haven't spoken to my colleague, so I would like to speak to my colleague, and I'm sure if you want to bring him on, he may be in a better position to clarify that for you.
Well, I can say what Dr. Peter Boylan is saying, and Dr. Peter Boylan knows more than probably anybody else in the studio about this situation and how these things are governed. He says, these proposals, this is what he says on Twitter, these proposals do nothing to address the reality that the site and the hospital will, as things stand, be wholly owned by a company set up directly by the Sisters of Charity under specific Vatican directives. There is not a single hospital anywhere in the world built on Catholic-owned land which permits procedures contrary to Catholic teaching. Does anyone seriously believe that the new National Maternity Hospital will be the only exception in the world? The position of myself and the Labour Party will be that this is incredibly infuriating, that in a country that calls itself a republic, we still have to go through these hoops as to who actually runs, owns, manages the education system in this country and the health system in this country.
It's specifically on this. I mean, this proposal...
At this point, and I think, I have to say, I think it's kind of poor form from one agency in this entire process to come out with a statement before we have heard from the minister or from you know, those who are representing the state. I think at this point, frankly, it's time for the church and those religious orders to read the room and to back off and get out, because we are constantly sort of wringing our hands and saying there has to be processes. These things are constantly delayed because this country has to talk to various different vested interests that no other country in Europe has to talk to when it comes to the delivery of basic care for women in terms of maternity services. And it's not good enough. And at this point, I think we need to be much stronger in our belief system and what the state has stand
do,
up for.
Do we need to start talking about another side of the state?
I think what needs to happen is quite clear. The church needs to back off. And if it comes to us having to CPO the land or to purchase the land, then we need to do that, because this has gone on far too long.
Well, but I'm trying to get to the bottom of what's happening. Verona Murphy, I'll bring you in on this, because, I mean, I'm reading the statement again. They're very pleased to confirm that discussions have concluded and our proposal, this proposal that we explained, an extended lease and enhanced board representation, has been accepted by the Department of Health.
And I think if we go back to what the Taoiseach said the last time, it was that there would be no semblance or even a perception of religious influence at the hospital. All that, what I've read in the Irish Times, seems they've rejigged directorships and they've reduced Vincent's input by one. And I think the question that has to be asked is, if there is not going to be a Catholic ethos attached to this hospital, then why are they on the board?
Robert Troy, just, you've seen what was in the Irish Times, the same as the rest of us. You've seen there now what the Vincent's Healthcare Group are saying. Would you be concerned if that proposal has been accepted?
I would be concerned that if any proposal was accepted that wouldn't ensure that all legally
permitted... Do you think that proposal, as it's been set out, would take us to where we need to go?
That is a very sharp synopsis of a proposal that I haven't seen.
Okay.
And it would be wrong for me to comment on a proposal that I have seen. But to answer your question, I think it would be wholeheartedly wrong that the state would invest money into a hospital, into a site that would not lead to all legally permissible services available in this country in context of women's health would not be available in that site.
Okay.
Can I just say, I think you're absolutely right, Katie. We have the CPO process for a reason. This has been delayed for long enough and the only people suffering here are the women of Ireland who need the service. I think it's time to take a stand and move on.
We will move on as well because I want to ask you about what the other part of that conversation with Paul Reid and what's happening in the hospitals now. We're opening nightclubs and we're closing hospital wards. And Tánaiste Leo Varadkar telling us that COVID-19 will be with us forever this week. If that is the case, when is the capacity issue in our health service going to be seriously addressed?
Well, the work on the capacity issue in the health service is ongoing. And it will continue to be ongoing. There was 800 additional beds brought on board so far this year in our health service. We have an increase in the number of ICU beds.
We
not
are
enough.
so far down the OECD list in terms of where we stand with our ICU capacity.
We are, and you'll understand that it's not something that can be turned on overnight. It does take time, and the investment is being made, and it is being built up on a steady and gradual basis. Unfortunately, it's not just simply about putting a bed into a ward, it's about ensuring that it's properly staffed, properly equipped, and work is ongoing in that regard. There's no doubt about that. We have invested huge resources in our health budget this year and last year, and in this year alone, we have seen a 25% increase in the number of ICU beds available. So I think it's unfair to say that the investment is not being made. It quite clearly is being made. Yes, would we like to see it being made quicker? Of course, but it does take time to get this right.
Aaron.
I think there's been a massive amount of complacency within government since we came back into the Dáil. All the energy seems to be about conversations about reopening and not about COVID. I do welcome the statement from Paul Reid about having an extra public awareness campaign around vaccination. I am concerned about the fact that I believe it's now 20% of young people are not vaccinated, don't intend to get vaccinated, and those people are those who will circulate more than the rest of us because they're out there meeting people.
Well, they
people
certainly circulate more now that we've opened nightclubs and the late bars.
But I would have to say, in terms of public policy, look, autumn and winter are utterly predictable. You know what I mean? The government needs to be able to predict these things, and the capacity should absolutely have been put in place heretofore. So I do think in terms of the energy, where the energy is in Leinster House, the energy is behind the reopening and behind the self-congratulatory feel from government and not around the statistics and the numbers that are beginning to climb up and make a lot of us feel very uncomfortable.
Well, if you recall, Katie, maybe 2-3 months ago here on your late debate show, I said that we had all our eggs in the vaccination basket. You were a bit taken aback by that, but what I meant was we need an armoury that supports the vaccination. We can see it now. Vaccination in itself, although credit, we had a wonderful vaccination programme, well rolled out and well taken up, but clearly it's not enough. We need to see, and I'm very concerned that we may have abandoned our test, trace and isolate system. We need to see containment measures that work and supported by antigen testing. That is something that could have been put into our schools. You know, we don't have a capacity in ICU. Government has put money in. There's an underspend in the HSE. There's frivolous waste in the HSE. And what we haven't seen is any benefit for the money that has been put in. And that's a grave concern. We had the longest lockdown in Europe in which to prepare for this, particularly as said by Aidan, this was entirely predictable. Luke O'Neill said as much 3 months ago also. Predictable, preventative measures needed to be put in place. All we see are reactive measures and it's getting us nowhere.
OK, we take a break and we'll be talking to Don Lucky from the Licensed Vintners Association after this.
Saturday with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back. Now, Keystone Cops meets Father Ted stuff. That was how the Licensed Vintners Association CEO Donal O'Keefe described the government process to reopen the nightclub sector. The LVA says requirements for advanced ticket sales for entry to nightclubs and late bars are completely unworkable. And I'm joined on the line now by Donal O'Keefe. Donal, you're welcome to the programme. You were at Good afternoon. You were at that meeting with department officials yesterday.
I was.
When did this issue of these advanced ticket sales being required, when did that emerge?
Well, we've had a shambolic process since Tuesday, since the press conference announcing the reopening of restrictions threw up for the first time at the last minute the notion there'd be operational guidelines for nightclubs. Then there was a vacuum where there was leaks and counter-leaks. There was two separate meetings between the industry and government on Thursday evening. On Thursday evening at 6 o'clock, ticketing was on the table. On Thursday evening at 7 o'clock, it was definitively off. And the guidelines that were supposed to be finalised on Thursday night had no mention whatsoever of ticketing. We waited for those guidelines to be published Thursday night, Friday morning, Friday mid-morning, Friday lunchtime, we were sure we had them. Late bars and nightclubs opened on Friday afternoon and evening. And at 6 o'clock last night, we got a call to attend an urgent meeting with government where ticketing was definitively, decisively in the guidelines, no discussion, no debate. So 6 o'clock yesterday evening, for late bars and nightclubs that had been closed for 585 days, on their first day of trading, a genuinely joyous occasion for those businesses, their staff, their customers, their suppliers, we get a bombshell dropped on us that takes no account whatsoever about how Irish people socialise, no account of how the industry works, no account of the difference between traditional bars, late bars and nightclubs, and simply, in our view, is unworkable as it stands.
Do we know yet? We still don't actually have these regulations, do we?
No, regulations have been published. They're due to be published, we understand, and be put into law by Thursday of next week in advance of next weekend's trading. Clearly, no ticketing is required for this weekend.
Okay. This idea of advance ticketing, though, do we know yet what we mean by that? How far in advance those tickets would have to be purchased?
No, we don't know. We were briefed on last night that it would be 24 to 72 hours. In advance this morning, we're saying that's not the case, but nobody can tell us what is. So the short answer is no, we don't know what's required in advance.
The Taoiseach was speaking today on News Talk saying that it can be done, the ticketing can be done, that administering ticketing can be done very easily, he says. And he says, you know, this just going back to there was a big row over the use of the COVID cert back in the summertime, and that was grand once it got going.
Well, could he explain to me how live music is going to function in a traditional bar, which is not a late bar or nightclub? Is that going to be a ticketed event? Because we understand under the guidelines as it stands today, it is. So impact number one here is that live music, DJs, individual musicians, bands who play in pubs up and down the country all the time are out of work now because no ordinary pub is taking live music in if it has to become a ticketed event. How is it going to work in late bars that, you know, in bars that transition into the late trade? So virtually every late bar in the country operates through the day, through the evening, and evolves into a late bar operation after 11 p.m. Are we supposed to kick all our customers out at closing time and readmit customers? Are we supposed to only admit ticketed customers if they intend to stay? If a visitor comes to Dublin from outside of Dublin, so up from the country or internationally, how are they? Are they supposed to have ticketed in advance? This thing is just plain nuts in our view.
But, you know, when you heard Paul Reid there talking about the huge pressure on our hospital and our health service generally, do you accept that it can't be a free-for-all, that you can't just throw open the doors and what happens?
Well, we have followed from the very first time this broke, back in the 15th of March 2020, when we agreed and supported the closure of pubs, that we will comply with public health advice as fully and as properly as is required. We now have a situation where there's guidelines for everything, no guidelines just definitively in place for late trade that we can understand. There's differences between pubs, hotels, restaurants, late bars, nightclubs, traditional bars, sports clubs, golf clubs. Nobody knows how this is supposed to operate. It just doesn't make sense to us.
Okay.
And the reality is that on Tuesday, following public health advice from NPHET on Monday, the government made the decision to open. We had been led to believe all along, and it's put all our eggs in the basket, that once vaccination rates got high, trade would begin to recover and reopen. We have a terrific, and the HSE deserve a lot of credit, a terrific vaccine rollout, 92% of the adult population vaccinated. We are only admitting vaccinated customers. 100% of our customers are vaccinated. So we have been led to believe that that would be sufficient to open on the 22nd of October. with, okay, the restriction that we had to continue to check COVID certs, which we're happy to do, maintain contact tracing, which we're happy to do. Okay. But then, because they're all vaccinated, we can trade.
OK, Donal, I'll just stay with us there on the line, please. I want to put some of this to our panel. Minister, this sector have been closed for nearly 600 days. Like, that description of the last few days before the reopening of total chaos, that's a disgraceful, surely, way to treat any sector.
Well, firstly, yes, you're right. This sector is closed nearly 590 days, and that's why I think yesterday is a positive day for the sector. It's positive in the fact that they can open again and they can start trading again.
And Donal has acknowledged that, but could you address his description?
I would if you'd
there.
Let me finish, yeah. Katie. I think it's a positive day, and I think we shouldn't forget that. And I think also in the last 590 days that this sector hasn't been able to address, they have been very well supported in terms of wage subsidies, deferral of their tax, court grants in terms of restart grants, the CRSP payments. So there has been an acknowledgement that this sector has been very adversely affected over the last 2 years. And I think that's a given. And I just want to make a point Donal raised in relation to any pubs that is playing traditional Irish music in the corner or whatever. They are not going to be included in terms of the ticketing arrangement.
So that what Donal understood
misconception. Well, I don't know whether he said he understood
it from
the...
I do want to come in here. I posed that question specifically because I do understand how the trade operates, and it was made specifically clear to us at 6:15 or 6:20 last night that any live music in any pub would be captured by these guidelines and accordingly must be ticketed. That was the clear advice, direction given to us last night.
Okay. What I would say, Donal, is my understanding is that there is a meeting with the stakeholders, again, first thing on Tuesday morning.
Correct.
My understanding is that the ticketing regime to be introduced is for venues that are opening for the first time or that opened for the first time last night, not for venues that have been opened since earlier this summer. And the reason that this is being brought in is because now that we have 92-93% of the people fully vaccinated, we do want to get the remaining sectors of the economy reopening. But in acknowledgement of where we are in terms of the number of people who have contracted the virus, in acknowledgement of the fact the number of people who are in hospitals, we do have to bring in additional measures, additional safety measures to protect people. And the concept of ticketing, it is going to be difficult. It is not ideal, but we are in unprecedented times. And what is it about? It's about ensuring that we have a record of the people who go in. Because when people are going to nightclubs now, there is no restriction on the capacity and people are allowed to dance. And because of that, there is an extra risk in that very activity itself. And it's to mitigate against that risk. It's to ensure that we have the names, okay, the addresses, to follow up contact tracing.
Okay. Katie? I'd just like to make one observation here. We are obliged in every pub in the country, hotel and cafe, restaurant in the country, to get contact tracing details. So we're getting those details. What's the advantage of a ticketing system over that? They have to be captured anyway. Ticketing system captures it for sure, but we're capturing it anyway. This just doesn't reflect how the business operates, how customers operate.
I want to bring in the rest of the panel. Aon, obviously Donal's very frustrated there, but the government are obviously trying to balance the risk and the...
Absolutely, and we have to, again, recall what Peter Reid was saying at the beginning of the programme and the pressures that are on the health system. And I can only speak for the Labour Party in terms of the opposition, we have been as supportive as we possibly can of government in terms of the national effort. We were the only party in the opposition to support a government bill 2 weeks ago in terms of keeping the legal framework around restrictions until January. We were the only party to vote in favour of that because we do feel it's a national effort and government has to be able to respond as things improve or disimprove, just to make that point. However, surely this is, clearly is chaotic when you have people coming out of the same meeting with two different interpretations. We have government spokespeople saying that, no, the ticketing arrangements can be something that you do within minutes of attending a venue. And those representatives from the industry saying, no, we're told it's 24 hours. And again, the regulations lapsed as of midnight on Thursday. So there's absolutely no regulations overseeing this new scenario. The Dáil does not sit next week. So we'll be waiting for the week after next in order to bring in regulations around this to make them legally binding. So I can completely understand where Dáil is coming from. But I would make this further point, that the industry does have responsibility in terms of ensuring that every single person that comes into any single venue or licensed premises has to show their certificate and their identification, because with the leadership that Dáil O'Keefe can show, we're going to have a better chance of making this a success. Okay, and I think everybody would realise and appreciate. I think lots of people would suggest that the oversight of the vaccination cert hasn't been as it could have been.
No, I think it's absolutely, I can hear the frustration from Dáil. I think it's inconceivable that we get guidelines at the 11th hour when the government announced over 7 weeks ago that D-Day was going to be the 22nd of October. It's mind-boggling. On top of that...
To be fair, the COVID scenario changed dramatically.
Everybody keeps saying COVID is evolving. We were here last year. Can you tell me what has government done except depend on the vaccination? A COVID cert is not a diktat that says I don't have COVID. It's a cert that says you're vaccinated. Now, clearly, vaccinated people are spreading COVID. Vaccinated people are getting COVID. So we can now go and ask those who are unvaccinated, but government has to put a support armoury in place. I would much prefer to see somebody going to their local pharmacy, having a clear antigen test, getting access to a nightclub. Doesn't depend on the nightclub giving it. We have a localised pharmacy network in every village in this country, whereby if you want to go out, this was the EU model, this is what they did in Spain, they've opened all of these institutions long and ever ago. Okay. By the way, you can go to a wedding. There is no restriction. You neither need to be vaccinated or unvaccinated. There's no limit to the guest list. You can dance, you can drink, you can stand at the bar. I think the negative aspect of this is the confusion that's ensuing. We need to look at the support armoury. Antigen testing localised through the pharmacy network, affordable and efficient.
Okay. Donal, before I let you go, are you going to keep going on this with this process? Are you going to try and work with this ticketing proposal?
Well, we have a meeting scheduled with government for 9 a.m. Tuesday. We're certainly going to engage with that. I mean, our understanding, based on the briefing last night, is that the political decision, the government decision to proceed with the ticketing arrangement is taken. There's no flexibility. It's a done deal. We're going to have to just cope with it. We've just made expressly clear how unworkable and what an appalling situation we've been placed in. But we will continue to engage with government on this early next week.
Okay, Donal, thank you for that. You just wanted to go in there before we leave it.
Yeah, I just want to make the point that, there was people, very few people in the Dáil, exactly only the government parties, who actually took the decision to bring in the vaccine pass at the time, and there was huge resistance at that time. And now there's a general acceptance.
I disagree with that, and I'll tell you why, Robert.
Just let Robert finish first, and I'll let you in, Brona.
There is a general acceptance that it is working well, and if you even speak to the industry, it's working well. There is a requirement on restaurants, there's a requirement on many other sectors in our hospitality industry to have pre-booking requirements in advance. I do believe this is going to be a challenge for the industry. I accept that and I get that, and I've spoken to Donal on many of occasions. But I do believe that we can work with the industry early next week to ensure, and that's why it didn't come in this week.
I'm sorry, in acknowledgement
that it's going to take time. We're going to work with the sector to ensure that this can be implemented.
The challenge here is for government to support the vaccinated. And I think the problem is here, we know that having a cert doesn't prevent COVID. It says you're vaccinated. There's too much confusion. We need to institute a proper test, trace and isolate system, or the contact tracing that the industry is doing is worthless. And on top of that, we need antigen testing.
Okay, just a couple of text before we leave this. Katie, the free-for-all opening up the country experienced yesterday's blatant populism. I'm furious at the government for not continuing with restrictions, given the appalling state of the virus is currently in the country. Another one, Katie, all the bars and clubs can run ticketed events when they want to. For example, at busy times like New Year's and Patrick's Day before the pandemic, it's even easier to do with loads of app services now. I think they're worried that it will become obvious from named ticketed events that they are not generally enforcing the vaccine cert rules. That's from Carl. And one more, Katie, this just goes to prove that this government are completely out of touch with reality. And that's Mike. There, we'll take a break. Tweet at Saturday RTE. Now, just in relation to that discussion we had earlier on the National Maternity Hospital, I am told to remind you that the Religious Sisters of Charity have no involvement now and will not have any future role in the management of St. Vincent's Hospital. This is a statement from the Religious Sisters of Charity from last June. They say we have no role whatsoever in St. Vincent's Healthcare Group, the new independent charity, or the new maternity hospital. So we just wanted to clarify that. And just before we leave the COVID issue, schools, the unions this week saying the contact tracing, the change in those contact tracing rules needs to be reversed. Verona, this was a big issue in Wexford, in your constituency.
Big issue. A lot laid on the shoulders of the principal at the CBS, Vicky Byrne. I think the reality is she got no support from the department or the HSE. The Board of Management made a decision to close on that basis. However, they were instructed to reopen. I think the public interest here and the health and safety of the children was displayed. Only a third of the children came back to school once the department said it had to open up.
But I suppose the department might say the school needed to be open for all those who wanted to send their children in there.
But the reality was it safe? The exponential increase in COVID with no contact tracing for close contacts made no sense. It doesn't make sense.
Okay. Aon, very quickly.
Well, essentially, what's at the centre of this is a lack of trust from the department to individual school principals, individual school boards of management.
Do we need to reverse the contact tracing?
Well, I think it needs to be looked at again. What was happening in September wasn't working. Clearly, there's an issue here as well. But I think what I heard from a Fine Gael minister yesterday, who was on RTÉ, saying, sure, if we'd have one school closed, should they all be at it? I mean, I think we have to realise that teachers and school communities and principals are keeping the show on the road. They're teaching in very difficult circumstances and teaching children often that the state has abandoned. So in this circumstance, I think the school should have been supported. Okay. We're almost at midterm break and a bigger issue was made out of this than needed to be. What actually happened was, because two-thirds of the students didn't come to school, there was no online learning taking place at all, because that's what would have happened if the principal had been supported.
Okay, very quickly, is there any appetite to reverse that rule in relation to contact tracing at schools? A lot of people feeling unsafe.
I think it could be reviewed rather than being completely reversed, but reviewed.
Well, I think, number one, I don't think it's appropriate to focus in on one particular case. And I do believe that, you know, the principals are being assisted and are being supported. And
clearly not, Robert.
And what has happened right
Didn't
along the way.
It look like that was the case now in relation to that particular case.
It is though. The HSC's lead to advise on public health advice in consultation with the principals. And I think we should be guided by the
HSC.
I don't think we should be guided by the HSC in terms of public health advice.
I think it's really important to say the testing and the contact tracing is part of keeping the schools open. That's the armoury I'm talking about here. And it's we can't have a system all right where every school makes their own decision, but we can have a government that organises contact tracing for every school.
There's another issue here.
There's
a substitution crisis that the minister seemed to be completely unaware of Thursday last week, and the very next day the department goes in contact with the teacher training colleges in terms of providing substitution. So, I mean, I don't know who is in touch what's happening on the ground, because the minister and the department certainly aren't.
Okay, I need to move on because I just want to get to this before we finish up, because the government this week announced a further funding for the CAP strategic plan, bringing total funding close to €10 billion. Meanwhile, an EPA report pinpoints agriculture as the single largest contributor to greenhouse gas emissions in the country. Robert Troy, agriculture emissions up 1.4% last year again. We keep coming back to it, but you can't get away from it. The national herd, it's been increased by the dairy herd, increased 45% in the last 10 years. Can we go forward without tackling that?
Look, the bottom line is the government has brought in legislation. We have targets to achieve by 2030. That's fact. They're legally binding targets that we have to achieve. You mentioned in relation to the emissions going up last year, the year before, they were decreased by 3.9% in the agriculture sector.
But over the last 10 years, they've gone up 12%.
Yeah, and what we need to do, and we need to ensure that each minister responsible for their own department works within that department to bring forward proposals in terms of how they're going to achieve the necessary reductions, because every department has a role to play in this. And I don't think it's fair to focus in on any one particular department, because every department has a role to play. We do know that this is a very important industry to our economy. And we do also know that Irish agriculture is well recognised as one of the most sustainable food producers in the world.
But then, you know, you say that, but the IFA says Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have been rolled over by the Green Party's Alice in Wonderland idea of rural Ireland.
Entirely. And if you look at what Brazil is doing, it's the total opposite. So I don't know how the minister can say, you know, that we're going to reduce the herd here. Sorry?
They're led by a head case.
Yeah, well, I think the problem here is that the government is not seeing and recognising that farmers... We will import beef from Brazil and increase the carbon footprint, just like has happened with our peat. We've stopped harvesting, but we've increased the world carbon footprint by importing it. So I don't know how you can ask a question like, what has Brazil got to do with this? If you're a farmer in rural Ireland, Robert, it has a hell of a lot to do with it. You cannot conceivably understand how you would reduce the herd here with what you just pointed out was sustainable beef production on green grass farming, the best beef in the world, and we're cutting down trees in Brazil to increase their herd.
Can I agree with the minister? Because I think, in fairness, it is far too easy for any one sector to point at another sector and say they're the problem. I think that sort of rhetoric from the IFA is very regrettable, making such a political point, because maybe Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil and Green Party, all in government, realise that this is an existential crisis that we're facing, and climate change is real, and in 30 years' time we're going to be looking at a very, very much depressed situation. I would like everybody in rural Ireland to realise, and everybody in urban Ireland to realise, that this is a national effort, and all of us have our part
to play.
And there will be, hold
on
a second,
why don't we look at the low-hanging fruit, such as taking away the toll barriers?
There's going to be no...
Every truck expends a litre of fuel when it's stopped. This has
it'll be impossible to achieve this without a level of pain. There's, but at the same time, at the same voices, we'll be complaining about drought and about floods and about fires in rural Ireland.
One last question. We're hearing any day now, every time we ask this question, but when will the Climate Change Advisory Council finally announce those carbon budgets?
I believe within the next fortnight. But can I just say, if we had Verona's opinion that we can't trade internationally, well, then the Irish beef wouldn't be able to trade and sell their beef into the rest of Europe.
I'm going to have to cut you off. We're actually totally out of time. Thank you all for joining us today. Thank you all for listening. The programme was produced by Mary O'Hagan. Research was by Andrew Fleming. The broadcast coordinator was Elaine Conlon, and Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound. Enjoy the rest of your bank holiday weekend.